Dear listener, you are about to listen to the on-demand version of the Naked American Songbook. Due to those pesky copyright restrictions, we can't include the complete recordings in this podcast. But you can still hear me get naked with Ira Glass, producer and host of This American Life. Home. You can never go home again. Anywhere I hang my hat is home. Home is where the heart is. When I think of home, I think of, well, Baltimore. It is, after all, my hometown, and I'm hardly the only legendary export from Charm City, the city that reads The Lady by the Bay. Among many other native sons and daughters, Baltimore claims Chick Webb, H.L. Mencken, Cab Calloway, Justin Vivian Bond, Edgar Allan Poe, John Waters, Johnny Unitas, Cal Ripken Jr., Barry Levinson, my late mother Ricky, my late mother Ricky's lifelong friend, the late Shirley Glass, and Shirley's son, Ira. That's right. Public radio's most valuable player, This American Life's Ira Glass, is Baltimore-born, too. So you think it would have been easier to get him on my show. But indeed, Ira was reluctant at first to play the guest on a radio show, even one from the son of one of his mother's oldest friends. I mean, we're practically cousins. But no matter. Once the multiple Peabody Award winner finally sat down and started sharing, well, it was like old home week. And it's a rich exchange I'm eager to share with you, but first, allow me to celebrate by sharing a recording of another of our hometown heroes. Neither Charm City nor the Naked American Songbook could hope for a more illustrious patron saint than Our Lady of the Great American Songbook. And here she is in uncommonly cheerful form. You can practically see her sauntering down Charles Street, the sunny side of Charles Street, that is. Here is Baltimore's own Billie Holiday.
Grab your coat and get your hat. Leave your worry on the doorstep. Just direct your feet to the sunny side of the street. Can't you hear a pitter-patter? And that happy tune is your step. Life can be so sweet on the sunny side of the street. I used to walk in the shade with those blues on parade. But now I'm not afraid. This rover crossed over. If I never have a cent, I'll be rich as Rockefeller. Gonna set my feet on the sunny side of the street. On the sunny side of the
From WMYC Studios, WQXR, and the Jonathan Channel, it's the Naked American Songbook. I'm Julian Fleischer. Today's show with This American Life host Ira Glass is in three parts. Act 1, Growing Up Glass. Act 2, Ira Gets His Wings. Act 3, Getting Under Ira's Skin. Stay with us. After we got some Baltimore talk out of the way, Ira and I talked about one of my guests from last season, the great Sheldon Harnick.
I met him once in just like the most casual setting where I was in a little recording studio that's near Broadway where a lot of Broadway people record and do demos and stuff, and then occasionally record more than demos. And we were recording a song there, and I was with this guy, John Kilgore, and an old man shows up at the door, and John says to me like, "Oh, Ira, do you know Sheldon Harnick?" And I was like, "What?" No, we haven't met. You're like a legendary figure of my childhood, you know, and adulthood. Like it was so weird that that could be a person that you could just meet and like, oh, do you know this guy?
Yeah, I was like, no, I know him. He's in my DNA.
Yeah, exactly.
Like my dad has asked me if I know my father. Well, I have to say, one of the honors of doing that particular episode was I finally got to look the man in the eye and say, you know, thank you for giving me my Jewish identity, because otherwise I wouldn't know how to be Jewish.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. That's a lovely thing to say. Thank you.
Can you imagine what we'd be doing? We'd be lost in the desert without the music of Fiddler on the Roof.
When we decided to do the show, we all remembered our childhoods. We remembered our growing up and our Jewishness and our bar mitzvahs.
Tell me a little bit about Fiddler in your life.
I mean, it's funny because I've just started to talk about this publicly, but I saw the recent production of Fiddler on the Roof on Broadway. Mm-hmm. I realized watching the show, like, I cried all the way through the first half of it. And the reason why I was crying was I realized, like, oh, my mom took me to this show so often. Like every year it would come through Baltimore to the Morris Mechanic Theater, Painters Mill Music Fair. Morris A. Mechanic Theater. Thank you for the fact check correction. Obviously, you would have caught that in post. You know, like, I last saw Fiddler on the Roof when I was a teenager, which is 40 years ago. Like, I'm old. And I realized I knew the entire thing by heart, like not just the songs, because obviously we had the record and we'd play it, but like I knew the punchlines to the jokes. I knew the setups to the jokes. People would like enter a scene and I knew what they were going to say. Like I knew when the guy playing Tevye was going to stand there and say, maybe that's why we always wear our hats. You know, like I just knew, like I just knew everything was going to happen before it happened. I was just like, I haven't seen this since I was a kid.
Okay, I'm going to set you up. You may ask, when did this tradition get started?
And I'll tell you,
I don't know.
Exactly.
Tradition. Tradition. Without our traditions, our life would be as shaky as a fiddler on the roof.
I don't know, man. It was like walking into a room 20 blocks from my house. And this sounds like such a big thing to say, but like it really felt like my childhood was still going on mm-hmm. intact, exactly as I remembered it. This so got inside me. And if I think about, in retrospect, like how I got to where I am in my life, like I was working at NPR. Like I was a producer for All Things Considered in Morning Edition. I was doing the overnight, writing intros for Morning Edition and editing Bob Edwards two ways or interviews and, you know, helping Nina Totenberg like get her story on the air. And like I was that was my job. And I was doing my own stories. And I think what happened to me is that I always had this feeling of like there's this thing that I want the stories to have, this feeling I want to have. And if you think about the structure of Fiddler on the Roof, what it is, it's like it's funny at the beginning and it's about how am I going to marry my daughters off. And then it becomes about something much, much bigger. And then it gets very sad at the end. And when I think about like, well, what is it that I actually make every week on the radio? That's what I'm making. It's a story that's kind of when it's working. It's like it's funny at the beginning. You get caught up in the characters and situation. And then in a good episode, it comes to be about something much bigger, some much bigger idea and something much sadder, really. And I feel like that somehow was the emotional template of what I wanted to make. And in a way, every week I'm kind of making Fiddler on the Roof mm-hmm. as journalism.
Right.
So it was hard to actually pick which thing to play from Fiddler on the Roof here on the show. Thought would be nice to play. Like, honestly, like the big numbers for me, I feel like I've heard them too many times, mm-hmm. like Sunrise, Sunset, and If I Were a Rich Man. It's just like a pop song I've heard too many times. And so the ones that affect me the most are sort of like the other incidental music, the other things that you just haven't heard that much. And so this is the Russian dance that I don't know why anybody would be listening to this particular show if they've never seen Fiddler on the Roof. But if there are...
You think?
Do you think there are people who listen to your show who have not seen Fiddler on the Roof?
Yes. Right, I actually do. I don't think there's a lot of them, but they need to be serviced as well as any of the others.
Okay, so basically we're in Russia. The story is there's a guy, he's marrying off his daughters. The actual plot of the thing is he has three daughters, and each one will do something that's kind of not what he wants in a greater, greater way until finally the third daughter
gets. Something that's Buck's tradition.
Right, something that Buck's tradition, right. And it just gets worse and worse, and it's about being a parent and watching your kids do that, among other things. And it's also about being a Jew and getting kicked out of Russia by the Russians. So when his first daughter is going to get married, he seals the deal, and she's promised to this boy, and he's in the bar drinking, and there's a big famous number, L'chaim, to life, and they do that. And then the Russians, who are also in the bar, who are the political force that runs the town and runs everything.
When you say the Russians, you mean the non-Jewish Russians, because this is part of the heartbreak of the show.
Right.
Is we're being stripped of our nationality,
right.
Accused of being placeless.
Yes.
Sorry, go on.
No, that's a good point. But these are the Russian officials,
right.
I should say, who control everything and who ultimately are going to kick them out of the town. And this is the moment in the play where you see the intimacy between the villagers and the Russian officials who are in charge of the town, and that they know each other and can kind of get along sometimes. And the Jews are drunk, the Russian officials are drunk. And then there's a dance. Mm-hmm. At the moment when the Russian comes in, it's just like with one long note, just sings this long, long note. The Jews are like dancing. He sings this long note that brings all attention to him. Apparently when you do Fiddler on the Roof, you have to sign a contract saying you'll use the original choreography for this scene.
Yep.
That Jerome Robbins?
Yes.
Choreographed for it. So it's this incredible choreography, this incredible physical, like, Russian dance that they do. So what you're seeing during this is the Russian official holds out his hand as this music plays underneath, and Tevye tentatively takes it with like two of his fingers, and then they start to slowly do a dance, and the Russian does a step, and Tevye imitates the step, and it gets faster and faster, and more people get involved, and they dance together. And then all the men start dancing, all the Russian officials and all the Jews start dancing, and it's just an incredibly beautiful moment.
And they get lost together in the ecstasy of the dance and the music, and it's a weird snapshot of what could be, and then it's, of course, rended apart like the clothes that Tevye rends at the end when he finally disowns his daughter.
Very poetic.
It's a masterstroke of storytelling, because later, when it all falls apart, the heartbreak is so much greater because you know there's that moment of connection that they could have worked to cultivate and instead follow orders.
And then the music itself is so beautifully done because it's a combination of this Russian music, but then they come in with the Jewish sort of die, this sort of fake davening. And it's like, so you couldn't make it up better. Like, it's just so beautifully done.
Have you read Alyssa Solomon's book?
Yes. After I saw that production, a Broadway person recommended it to me, and I loved it so much. This is this book called Miracle of Miracles, where she just walks you step by step through how Fiddler on the Roof ended up on stage. And apparently there had been like 40 years of people trying to turn it into a Broadway hit.
From the Shalom Aleichem stories.
Yeah, from including Shalom Aleichem, the guy who wrote the original stories, kept thinking, this is how I'm going to make my money. And people kept failing. And then she just walks you through Sheldon Harnick and Jerry Bach, and what they had to kind of throw away and what they had to invent, and including, like, they just kept writing songs and rejecting them. The song that explains the whole show, that opens the show, Tradition, they actually added kind of late. So people didn't even understand the show for a while, and then they had this idea for a song. And I have to say, like, I had never read a book about somebody making a show. It's so wonderful to read all the dumbass things they do that they think are going to work and that don't work. And then they just invent this aesthetic for the thing that's completely original and make a series of choices and then have to execute the choices. And, like, I found it so that's my week every week. It's right. just like we are running at so much material and we end up killing half of it or more, and like just deciding what is this show about? Like the show we're working on for next week, is it about rules? Is it about dictators who have complete power? Is it just even finding the thing that the show is trying to be and where the best material is? It's just like, oh my God, it's such a process of trial and error.
I think what the book helps to capture and what Sheldon spoke to briefly in our interview was they had to keep backing away and let the material tell them, you know, that as long as they were trying to tell the material what to do, it would push back and they would have a problem. And then when they finally just let the material speak to them, it took shape. Now, of course, we all experience in its finished product this thing which seems so inevitable and perfect and dominates so many people's imagination. But it was hard work, real day labor to get it finished, as you point out. And I think that's an inspiring message for anybody who's trying to create something meaningful in their lives.
The other thing that's interesting is that there was a lot of like Jewish kitsch that they had to jettison that had been part of earlier productions. And in fact, they consciously tried to tone down his Jewishness, which is a crazy thing to say because it's such a Jewish thing. But there was like a lot of like Yiddishy shtick. And should he even like use Yiddish phrases? And they're very careful of Hebrew and Yiddish in the play. L'chaim is like one of the few Hebrew words that you hear in the whole play.
To life, l'chaim, 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 to life.
And they translate it. And yeah, they were always concerned that they would get a non-Jew audience.
Otherwise, they'd wear out their Jewish audience and be left with no one.
Yeah.
But as we all know, this show took on a life far beyond the borders of Anatevka. It was translated into Hebrew and Japanese, bringing people together in suffering. What else did you listen to as a kid growing up?
My dad was a huge Sinatra fan. This is the music that played in my house as a child. It was Sinatra and Broadway show tunes in our house, and not the Beatles or the Monkees.
Oh, I could hide 'neath the wings of the bluebird.
I remember when I was a kid, my across-the-street neighbor, Mark Nasdor, trying to engage me in a discussion over which band was better, the Beatles or the Monkees. And I remember thinking, are we supposed to have an opinion on the Beatles at all? Like, is that even, like, it was sort of in my world, not really. Like, that wasn't the music of the house that I grew up in. I wasn't cool. Yeah, and so that was the music. And I'm sorry, the thing I was about to say, but I stopped myself, I'm not even going to say it.
Say it.
It's just surprising I'm heterosexual. That's how it ended up, given the musical taste of my childhood.
You're not the only person who's observed that.
About myself?
No, I mean about straight guys who like Broadway. Like, apparently it's like a kind of scarlet letter. If you like Broadway, you must be gay. And I was arguing earlier today, there's a lot of straight guys who enjoy Broadway.
Yeah, there you go.
A lot of them are actually from our generation, raised in Jewish families for whom Broadway was a real thing.
And it was a real thing.
They would bring home these soundtracks from their trips to New York, and we would grow up on them.
Well, it was the culture of East Coast Jews in the 60s and early 70s, probably the 50s too. And so if you grew up in one of those houses, that was the culture of your house.
Yeah.
Remember the Neil Patrick Harris opening of the Tonys a couple of years ago? It's not just for gays anymore.
Yeah. So things are made round. 30 years later, it's not just for gays anymore. Again.
Because Broadway has never been broader. It's not just for gays anymore. If you feel like someone that this world excludes, it's no longer only for dudes who like dudes. Attention, every breeder, you're invited to the theater. It's not just for gays anymore.
My guest, Ira Glass, surprisingly not gay by his own admission, credits his success in public radio to Fiddler on the Roof and the Broadway musicals he grew up loving. But that's just the beginning. Next, Ira gets his wings. In a moment from WNYC Studios, WQXR, and the Jonathan Channel when our program continues. I'm Julian Fleischer. This is the Naked American Songbook, and my guest is Ira Glass, public radio personality / mogul and the host of This American Life. We've arrived at Act 2 of our program. Ira gets his wings. Now, you too, like I, might be surprised to have discovered that the distinctive voice we hear each week on This American Life is heavily influenced by The Boss, The Boss. That is right. Ira Glass super loves Bruce Springsteen.
Yes, and I really super love Bruce Springsteen. Like, Bruce Springsteen is really the first rock star that I really loved and went to the concerts and had a really emotional attachment to. You know, being from Baltimore, as you know, Bruce Springsteen hit us earlier than he hit the rest of the country because he was sort of a star in Philly,
right,
and in Jersey. And so before he was a national star in the same way, like, I remember when Greetings from Asbury Park came out, like, his first record. Like, so this is before Born to Run.
Did you get it at the Rotunda?
Yes.
You did?
Yes. Oh my God. At the record store at the Rotunda. Yes, actually, we did.
Record Masters, yeah, is what it was, yeah, called. I used to go there every Thursday with my dad after dinner at Horn and Horn. Remember Horn and Horn?
Yeah.
That's the classy operation my dad was taking us to.
That's nice.
But Record Masters for me was a temple with fluorescent lighting.
Yeah.
So can you recall for me what happened when you first heard Springsteen? Like, what caught you?
I was in high school. My sister, my older sister Randy, was off in school in Philadelphia, and she got the record, and she basically said, like, listen to this. And then I think that because I'd been raised on Broadway show tunes, just literally, like, the stories and characters and melodies in that first record, Asbury Park, and then the second record, which I liked more, The Wild, The Innocent, and The East Street Shuffle, I experienced it as show music at first, and then understood it as rock music. Like, I only understood rock music once I went to a Springsteen concert. I was like, oh, this is what this is about. It's about this different feeling that's not the stories or this other thing. Feeling of, like, a huge, loud, exciting guitar-based noise, the roughness of it, which doesn't exist in Broadway. And, you know, if I had named before I went and saw him in a concert for the first time when I was a freshman in college, like, if I had named my favorite song, it would have been something like Spirit in the Night, which is built around a sax riff. And that goes do 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 do, and, like, it's built around that. It's sort of gentle, but then when I saw him, I was like, oh, this is like a different thing, and it was so exciting.
It's thrilling when someone who's so good at one thing suddenly turns around and delivers a different flavor completely and does so with total mastery.
Yeah, yeah. I have to say, like, it's been interesting. He's never gone back to that early sound, that early sort of more jazz-based sound. Like, there's some stuff that he does in those first two records that's just gone forever, which is fine. Like, no reason for it to come back, but, like, that was a nice sound for him.
You like this piano-only version of Thunder Road.
Yeah, this is his Angel Eyes, basically. And, yeah, it's just him and the piano. It's a concert version. And this is a song that I'd always loved, but I feel like he totally milks what it can do in a very Sinatra-like way. And there was a long time where, if I was ever at a karaoke bar, like, this would be the song that was my go-to. It's a vast song in itself. And he has a bunch of songs that are basically Start Small, Get Big, you know, like, yep, and Hit the Road. Mm-hmm. And I feel like of all of them, you know, Rosalita, Born to Run, like, there's five or six of them, which are, like, those sort of the core Springsteen road songs. Like, this one is, as far as I'm concerned, like, the best one, the most emotional. It's just the way the melody works, the way the build works. Just, there's so much feeling in it.
Screen door slams. Mary's dress waves like a vision. She dances across the porch as the radio plays Roy Orbison singing for the lonely. Hey, that's me, and I want you only. Don't turn me home again. I just can't face myself alone again. Don't you run back inside, darling, you know just what I'm here for. So you're scared and you're thinking that maybe we ain't that young anymore. Well, show a little faith, there's magic in the night. You ain't a beauty, but hey, you're all right. Oh, and that's all right with me. You can hide with your covers and study your pain. Make crosses from your lovers, throw roses in the rain. Waste your summer praying in vain for a savior to rise from these streets. Well, now I'm no hero, that's understood. All the redemption I can offer, girl, is beneath this dirty hood. with a chance to make it good somehow. Hey, what else can we do now? Except roll down the window and let the wind blow back your hair. Well, the night's busted open, these two lanes will take us anywhere. We got one last chance to make it real, to trade in these wings on some wheels. Climbing back, the Alphonse waiting down on the track. Can I so come and take my hand? We're riding out tonight to case the promised land. And I learned how to make it talk. Yeah, my car's out back if you're ready to take that long walk from your front porch to my front seat. The door's open, but the ride, it ain't free. Hey, I know you're lonely, and there's words that I ain't spoken, but tonight we'll be free. When all the promises will be broken, there were ghosts in the eyes of all the boys you sent away. They haunt this dusty beach road in the skeleton frames of burned out Chevrolets. They scream your name at night in the street. Your graduation gown lies in rags at their feet. And in the lonely cool before dawn, they're gone on the wind. So Mary, climb in. It's a town full of losers and I'm pulling out of here to win.
Thunder Road by Bruce Springsteen, live at Hammersmith Odeon in London, recorded in 1975. Ira, you mentioned you thought this was Springsteen's Angel Eyes. Tell me about Angel Eyes.
Angel Eyes is my favorite recording of Sinatra, just because the grand sadness of him is in there. And it's the version of him that I think is one of his favorite versions, too. That he has so much swagger in certain songs, and he certainly is at home in the swagger, but he's so much more appealing when he's melancholic. Mm-hmm. And he fancies himself a saloon singer in this way that's long past he's a saloon singer, and it's sort of like a nostalgic place that he goes to, which I find a little corny. But
it worked, though. Sometimes that stuff just works. I think it was his daughter Nancy who once referred to him as a winner who sympathized with losers.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe that's a little of what you're hearing.
Yeah.
I always thought that was a brilliant way of describing him.
That's Donald Trump, too.
No. Donald Trump is a loser who sympathizes with winners.
Well, we'll just disagree on this.
Except I'm right.
I mean the way that Donald Trump sees himself.
That may be the way Donald Trump sees himself, but I think the beautiful irony of the truth is that the opposite is the truth. And I think what Nancy Sinatra said about her dad was actually true.
Okay. I think you're probably right in all these things.
Did you get that? Great. Thank you. Okay, we can go now.
Ladies and gentlemen, I thank you. And I hope this doesn't come as a severe shock, but I'm through. Oh, yeah. Oh, it's boozing time.
One more.
One more what? I'm going to the bar. I'll be saying that to the waiter in a minute. One more, please. Hey, drink up, all you. Order anything you see. And have fun, you happy people. The drink and the laughs on me. I try to think that love's not around. Still, it's uncomfortably near. My poor old heart, it ain't gaining any ground. Because my angel eyes ain't here. Angel eyes, the old devil sent, they glow unbearably bright. And need I say that my love's misspent, misspent with angel eyes tonight. Go ahead and drink up, all of you people. Order anything you see. Have lots of fun, you happy people. The drink and the laughs on me. Pardon me, but I gotta run. The fact's uncommonly clear. I gotta find who's now the number one, and why my angel eyes, she ain't here. Excuse me while I disappear.
The great Francis Albert Sinatra, live at the Sands, from the 1966 Reprise album with Count Basie. The whole thing is worth checking out, but my guest Ira Glass wanted to hear that one, comparing this to the Thunder Road recorded live by Springsteen in 1975. I also want to point my happy listeners to our show page, NakedAmericanSongbook.org, for another performance of Angel Eyes from Old Blue Eyes, from his supposed farewell concert, at which his audience could not be blamed for thinking his disappearance was for real. However, he came back, as we will, with more Sinatra and some palm wine music from Sierra Leone. Act 3, when our program continues. I'm Julian Fleischer, getting naked this hour with Ira Glass. We're discovering what music makes Ira groove, and now Act 3, getting under Ira's skin. Ira brought some international music that was completely new to me. It's very fun, if potentially objectionable in the lyrical area. I asked Ira to tell me about how he first discovered the S.E. Roji song, Please Go Easy With Me.
This is a Sulemani Roji, and this is a kind of African music called palm wine music. I think he's from Sierra Leone. And I had a few years where I was the editor of the public radio show Afropop. So I had like a bunch of years of immersion in African music. And so there was, wow, I was listening to that music all the time. And this particular song, though, like, first of all, it's just he's an incredibly beautiful singer and does these octave jumps in a lot of the songs that are so beautiful. And the guitar playing is beautiful. And when I hear it, it's these old scratchy recordings where, like, it reminds me a little bit of the feeling you get from Robert Johnson. Yeah. And, like, just super heartfelt, beautiful singing. And for years and years before I was on the radio, I was a producer, and I was not somebody who even wanted to be on the radio myself. I started working at NPR in Washington when I was 19. And really, like, the first decade I'd worked in public radio, I just was a producer. I mean, just a producer, I loved it. And I really wasn't on the radio myself until I was about 30. this is from that period. And I got to know the song because I was one of the producers of All Things Considered, and we got a new host, Renee Montaigne, who then went on to like be a host for years and years and years. And Renee had been a very accomplished reporter, but she wasn't used to doing the kind of host interviews that you do as a host of a national radio show. And so she was used to like asking people questions and cutting up their answers and not doing a thing where it had a sequence. She hadn't done that particular thing before. And so to get her in practice, I created a segment for All Things Considered where she would do the same interview each week. We would find somebody for her to interview, and she would just ask them, what are you listening to? So it was super simple. Just what are they listening to? Why? What do they get out of it? And we would set up a combination of musicians. But a lot of it was just like, I remember one week we called the guys who were in the missile silos in, I think, Nebraska.
North Dakota, actually.
And what did they listen to down there? And the answer was Barbra Streisand. They were that particular week.
I'm through playing with fire.
So gay people are guarding our nukes?
I can't speak to that question, but perhaps. In any case, I would feel safer.
Yeah.
Or I feel very safe, actually, now. I don't. That's an interesting
but
joke. It's
right.
a cheap joke. But anyway, so Rye Cooter came on, and this was one of the songs that he picked. And he had a whole explanation for it that was so beautiful. He said, basically, I know nothing about this guy, but he had a whole dream in his head of what this music was. He's like, this is the kind of music that's made in a way that we don't make it anymore, where basically a lot of music was made back in the day in places where people were just coming together naturally in hotels. And there'd be a bar in the hotel, and it'd be the one place where there was music in a town. And you'd have people from the town and people from out of town, and there'd be a bar and there would be a band. And he's like, I want to be in that band because there's people there and there's people. He had a whole dream of this. There's
Which
people
became the Buena Vista Social Club.
It did, actually. Yeah, yeah,
because
exactly.
That's exactly what you just described.
Yeah. And he says, like, I want to be in that band because that's where music is naturally happening. You're getting feedback from the dancers who are dancing, and he's like, that's what I hear when I hear this music.
Now, mister, please go easy with me. I said, please go easy with me. I quite agree that you can dance very well. Now what I want is an easy movement, so can they go gently with me? I don't love you when you're holding my hand and why you did up me like this. I don't love you when you're touching my breast and I'll try to be at your best. Oh, Mr. Pinky, if I said you're leaving with me. Now what I see is that you're getting too hot, so please suppress your feeling. I say, mister, please suppress your. So, mister, I say, suppress your.
Kills me. I don't know anybody else who does that. It's so beautiful.
It's also a strange song. The lyrics kind of troubled me when I really listened to it. It's like the West African version of Baby It's Cold Outside.
Yes.
And someone's pushing themselves on someone else.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
So yeah. I just wanted to know if you consider that in your choice of a song that you love a lot.
No, that is, it's funny. It's because when I put it on the list, I hadn't heard it in a while. I had forgotten about that. But now that you say it, yeah, no, that's fascinatingly part of the song, is that the lyrics are disturbing.
And he's singing the part of a woman.
Yeah. He also has another song, which is like, oh, it begins with him like imitating the woman and the man talking to each other.
Oh, darling, it's gone past midnight. And won't you do me justice now?
Okay, honey, will you come along now?
Mm-hmm.
Can't you feel the night so very cold? The bed and blanket are so cold. Pull me closer and put out the light and then do me justice. Oh, darling, be you. I said do me justice now.
Palm Wine guitarist S.E. Roji. Another selection by my guest Ira Glass. Ira, I want to make sure we get to talk today about Cole Porter's I've Got You Under My Skin. And you don't have a version you want to hear? You're just a fan of the song, is that right?
Oh, no, I have a version that is my favorite version.
Which is
sure.
It?
It's the Sinatra version that's arranged, I think, by Nelson Riddle.
Yeah.
And I can tell you why it's my favorite. I have a couple reasons.
I would be eager to hear them.
For one, it's the version that I grew up hearing. My dad was a huge Sinatra fan. So that's one of the reasons. But the other reason is like when you hear the production on this sound, I feel like the way the horns work, the way that the little trumpet comes in now and then, like just the way it gets big and small, the way his voice is placed among the instruments, it's like music technology, or technology isn't even the word, a kind of arranging that had been developing and developing and developing was at its very height. And you get the feeling that like they finished this recording and they just felt like they had done the moon landing or something. Like there was just no place else to go with this style. It is completely fulfilling and aesthetic and fulfills it so perfectly and defines it so perfectly. It's like at the end of that song, you couldn't do it better.
No,
like it's
exactly
it's just
right.
Like they have gone as far as they can go, and they must have just felt like such motherfuckers. You know what I mean? Just like there's just no space left for anybody else. They have said it, they've made their statement. It's just like it's
complete.
It's complete. It's big and it's small and it's full of feeling in every particle. It owns the space that it's in so fully.
Okay, so we've already acknowledged that the song itself is one of the great pop songs. It's a perfect song. Number one.
I know nothing about this song.
But this arrangement about which you're so excited, justifiably, it's considered by many arrangers to be the greatest arrangement in pop music, too.
Is that true?
It's taught in all arranging courses as like the ultimate perfect arrangement of the perfect song. And it was written by Nelson Riddle at 5:30 in the morning, that morning, in the car, while his wife was driving him to the studio with a flashlight in his mouth and the score paper on his knees, because Sinatra had called him that night and said, "We're recording I've Got You Under My Skin in the morning."
Wow.
He wrote it in the car.
I feel like that's a really great example of don't think,
right.
just feel. Do it fast.
Right, if you're Nelson Riddle.
First thought, best thought. Allen Ginsberg used to say it, too.
Your old buddy Allen Ginsberg.
No, I don't know Allen Ginsberg at all. I just am an adult who knows a
tiny bit. But he worked with your cousin.
He did, and actually I know this because Philip quotes Allen about that.
Your cousin Philip Glass.
My cousin Philip Glass. Yeah.
And furthermore, that was the 14th take, the one that we all know.
Oh, that's interesting.
But it was Sinatra who kept calling for more takes, because I think he knew what you feel, which is that they could get a little further, they could do more. And it also grew out of Sinatra and Nelson Riddle's conversations about Ravel, because it turns out that Ravel was Sinatra's favorite composer, and they were interested in how Ravel built dynamically over the course of a whole piece. The repeating gesture, it gets sort of ecstatic in a way.
Oh, that's interesting. The notion of like, let's start smaller, bigger,
yes.
bigger.
Yes, that terrorist thing that they do.
Yeah.
And then the explosive trombone solo, one of the great moments in American pop music.
I feel so affirmed by the fact that you're saying that the song I always thought was like this amazing arrangement and there's nothing else to be said is seen by other people who actually know what they're talking about as being that. I had no idea.
No, you have good taste, Ira. if we leave here today with you feeling nothing else,
I want to affirm. I feel affirmed. I do. I mean, like you, I make a living from my taste, so.
Yeah. With the possible exception of the lyrics to that one rapey song from Africa, I would say that all of these songs have been pretty great.
But even the lyrics of that song are kind of like, what's going on in this song?
Yeah, it's pretty clear.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, you're going to hear a killing slide trombone solo by Milt Bernhardt. This is Nelson Riddle's legendary arrangement for the Sinatra album, Songs for Swingin' Lovers.
I've got you under my skin. I've got you deep in the heart of me. So deep in my heart that you're really a part of me. I've got you under my skin. I tried so not to give in. I said to myself, this affair never will go so well. But why should I try to resist when, baby, I know so well? I've got you under my skin. I'd sacrifice anything come what might for the sake of having you near, in spite of a warning voice that comes in the night and repeats in my ear. Don't you know, little fool, you never can win. Use your mentality, wake up to reality. But each time that I do, just the thought of you makes me stop before I begin. 'Cause I've got you under my skin. Sacrifice anything, come what might, for the sake of having you near, in spite of a warning voice that comes in the night and repeats how it yells in my ear. Don't you know, little fool, you never can win. Why not use your mentality? Step up, wake up to reality. Time I do, just the thought of you makes me stop just before I begin. 'Cause I've got you under my skin. Yes, I've got you under my skin.
Yeah, the story goes on that when Riddle arrived at the studio while the sun was coming up, he handed the score to his copyist, who like fanned out around the studio, furiously writing out their parts, handed them out, and boom. In under 12 hours, the whole thing arrives on the planet like this.
I just got chills you saying that.
Okay, keep those chills. We have just enough time for a quick game of this or that.
Gotta be this or that.
I'm going to give you two quick choices, and I just want you to pick one or the other. I may ask you to explain, or we may move on. All right, it's quick and easy. Glass, Philip or Stiegel?
Philip.
Okay. Ira, Gershwin or Levin?
Gershwin.
Why?
he's a much greater artist. Okay. He invented a whole thing. He synthesized an entire world and made it anew. I really think he was a writer.
Right.
This Perfect Day, Stepford Wives.
Come on.
Great books, but come on.
Yeah. It's not, but not for me.
Yeah, but not for me.
There you go.
Yeah.
Sedaris, David or Amy?
Oh, I know them both. This isn't a fair one. Okay. I have to recuse myself. I love them both.
Well done. Walters, Barbara or Art Gallery?
Art Gallery. This is a weird game because somehow the jokes all go to you. Like there's nothing left for the responder to do.
I guess you figured it out then, didn't you?
Pre-built in all the funny and you get it. Okay,
you Kobayashi Maru'd my game. All right. Gilbert, Godfrey or Anne Sullivan?
Oh, please, Godfrey.
Tell me why.
I love him. I love him. I was just on his podcast, actually. Like, I love him so much. I've seen him a million times. My wife is a super fan of his. I've seen his act so many times, I can do his act for you.
Okay, do a tight 2 minutes.
I mean, I can't do it in his voice, but like one of my favorite jokes of his. Why does butter get its own compartment in the refrigerator of all the foods? Why did butter? And all the other foods are like, ooh, butter's coming through.
explain that one pretty well. Jews, Christmas or Hanukkah?
Oh, Hanukkah. We didn't celebrate Christmas. I thought you were going to say book Jews or money Jews.
Oh, you mean Russians or Germans.
Wow, you're really in the game. Yeah, we were money Jews. My family, yeah, though my parents aren't happy when I say that. But yeah, it wasn't about books. It was about money.
Interesting.
We didn't have money. We didn't have money. That's why it was about money. Both my parents grew up in households where, like, they were not middle class at all, and they worked their way into the middle class.
Fascinating. All right, I like it. One more. Charm, bracelet, or city?
Charm City. That is such a deep cut. That was Baltimore's name for itself back when we were kids. That was like in one of these urban renewal things where they're trying to make Baltimoreans, you know, feel better about the blighted city that they lived in. And so they had a campaign, Charm City USA, mm-hmm. which was like a city sucking its thumb. And it was just laughable.
It was laughable. And yet somehow it remains. People still call it Charm City.
But ironically.
I love Baltimore.
No, I'm saying I grew up in Baltimore, but people call it Charm City, ironically.
But it's charming.
Like, it's charm. It's. Sure.
Ira Glass, you're a very good sport. Thank you so much for getting naked with us here. Can we have one more song, or is this just one of those things?
This is Nellie McKay's recording of It Was Just One of Those Things. You know that song?
No.
You, of course, you know that song. So she's playing the piano, and she fucking kills it. She, like, her piano playing is so wonderful in that song, and she's a really good pianist, but she's just dazzling in the solos of that song.
Great. I love Nellie McKay. I've had the privilege of singing some stuff with her, and she's a truly sui generis performer.
Yeah, I agree. She's amazing.
Her own complete invention. She exists in some very singular spot, which is very rare.
But I see all that. And then listening to this recording was a moment where I remember thinking like, oh, you have unbelievable chops just as like a player and improviser. Like, and I really wondered, like, were these like riffs that she had done before or are they improvised? They're so perfectly done.
Well, I can tell you the answer is almost always a combination of the two. Even Ella Fitzgerald, the great improviser of all time, had routines that she would return to.
Oh, that makes sense.
Or just places you could fall back on if you get lost or what have you, or a place to bounce off of. But not to take anything away from Nellie's incredible talent, because she also doesn't announce herself that way. Like, you show up and she's just some gal. There she is, and she doesn't reek of...
No, that's one of the things I love about it, is the utter unpretentiousness of it. There's just a real purity to her, and she's such a great singer, and her taste is so interesting.
Yeah.
So much of it is about a person's taste, and just skill of what she's doing rhythmically and the melodies she's inventing are just, it's so fun to listen to.
Let's listen, as we go out today, to Nellie McKay's masterful rendition of Just One of Those Things, another Cole Porter tune. Thank you.
those things. Just one of those crazy flings. One of those bells that now and then rings. Just one of those things. Just one of those nights. Just one of those fabulous flights. A trip to the moon on gossamer wings. Just one of those things. If we thought a bit of the end of it when we started painting the town, we'd have been aware that our love affair was too hot not to cool down. So goodbye, dear, amen. Here's hoping we meet now and then. It was great fun, but it was just one of those things.
Dreamy Nellie Mackay's tasty arrangement of Just One of Those Things by the great Cole Porter. The last selection by my guest, Ira Glass. Ira, thank you so much for spending this time with us on the Naked American Songbook.
Huh.
Obviously been a great pleasure for me. I hope it's been
and
a pleasure.
And for me too. Yeah, it's been so fun.
The Naked American Songbook is a production of the Jonathan Channel, WQXR, and WNYC Studios in New York City. Our Naked American team includes producer Aaron Dalton, assistant producer Ellie Smerling, production assistant Hilary Bonhomme, and executive producer Mike Shobe. Our theme music is written by me. Who am I? Why, I'm Julian Fleischer, host of the Naked American Songbook. Thanks again for listening. Please share our show with all your friends, and by all means, for God's sakes, keep it naked.
Oh, my God.
You're fascinating.
I have never talked to anyone about songs for this long in my entire life. I've never talked about music for this long.